It turned out that Sister Ariel Wyantzefasti had stayed in Taurus Bend for several weeks, and the villagers knew her well. Though few people were comfortable having a sister in their presence, she had struck them as scholarly, absent-minded, and kind. The description was an immense comfort to Aline. It meant the letter was probably legitimate. It left her with a problem. Did she go north toward the Chantry after Yuli, or did she go west after Kyler? She decided she had to go after Yuli. Sonaria wasn't safe for her. Her presence would make Kyler's work harder to accomplish, and she couldn't help him. The Chantry was safe, if intimidating, and Aline would at least make sure that Yuli was safe, if not take her home. So she'd continued north the next morning. Aside from nearly exhausting her small savings, a night in a bed had only seemed to remind her body of all its aches, so she wasn't making good time. She'd get to the Chantry faster if she made her horse go faster than a walk, but the very thought of a canter made Aline groan. The mare's ears flicked up, as if wondering what she was saying. Then, Aline saw the rider 40 paces away. He wore black armor, though no helmet, and he carried neither sword nor shield. He was hunched over in the saddle on a small, long-haired horse. The man's hand was pressed to his side, covering a wound, his pale face spotted with blood. As Aline pulled her mare to an abrupt stop, he looked up and saw her.
Oh, help! Oh, please!
Aline flicked her reins and came to his side. Despite the pain on his face, he was a handsome young man, barely older than she was.
Oh, water!
Aline grabbed her water skin, then paused. The young warrior had a full wineskin dangling from his saddle. His pallor wasn't the paleness of blood loss. He was Caladoran. His eyes lit with triumph even as she dug in her heels. He snatched the rein nearest him. Aline's mare danced in a circle that the man's smaller horse quickly followed. Aline tried to jump out of the saddle, but her leg was trapped between the horses. Then his mailed fist flashed. It was a descent into hell. Logan was still too weak to do even half of the work in lowering himself, but Nasher seemed content to do almost all of it, lowering them hand under hand. Logan just watched. The first 20 feet was sheer black fire glass that made up the hole, utterly smooth and featureless. Then the hole opened up in an enormous chamber. Iridescent green algae clung to the distant walls and gave off just enough light to see dimly. And it was as if they'd plunged into an alien world. The rotten egg smell was sharper down here, and puffs of heavy smoke rolled up toward them, obscuring Logan's view of thousands of stalagmites jutting unevenly from the invisible cavern floor. The howlers were quiet, and Logan prayed they would stay that way. Over the months, he'd lost his confidence that the sound was merely wind rising through the rocks. Nasher was obviously getting tired, but he maintained the same pace, hand under hand. All around them, except from directly beneath the hole itself, stalactites glistened like icy knives. They descended for 2 more minutes before Logan saw the first corpse. It was desiccated from the hot, dry winds, but it must have been a holer who had fallen, been pushed, or jumped decades or centuries ago. The body rested, impaled for so long on a stalagmite that the rock was growing over it, the stone slowly entombing the man. Then there were others. Nasher had to slow his descent several times to push off from stalagmites, and each time they saw inmates who'd never had rope. Some were even older than the first, their bodies gashed from hitting several stalagmites on the way down. Some were missing body parts, having had them sheared off by the rock or fallen off through the years. But the slickness of the stalagmites had prevented rats from getting to them, and a sear wind had kept them from rotting. The only unrecognizable bodies were the few among the wetter areas by the wall that had become homes for the algae. These glowed green like ghosts trying to pull out of the wall. Finally, they began reaching ledges. Most of them too far off to one side for Logan and Nash to reach, But on one, against a wall, he saw a corpse seated. His dried-out bones were intact. Somehow, this man had lived through the descent, whether he'd used a rope or just fallen and been spared through some miracle. Then he'd died down here. His empty eye sockets stared a question at Logan.
Can you do better?
Suddenly, the sinew rope shook. Logan looked up, but there was only blackness. His vision below was blocked by Nasher.
Let's hurry, Nasher. I know, you're doing great. You're doing fantastic. But I don't know how long Lily can hold the rope. We don't want to end up like these guys, do we?
Nasher went faster. They passed another ledge, and Logan saw that the ground around the base of the stalagmites was thick with soil rather than bare rock.
Soil? Here.
Not soil. Human waste. Generations of criminals had been kicking their feces into the hole. Among the spires of rock, not all of it was dried, so the entire area smelled like an open sewer with rotten eggs mixed in. Logan started to turn away when he saw something glint as they passed right next to another ledge. He looked again and couldn't see anything.
Stop for a second, Nash.
Logan reached his hand into the 6-inch deep layer of shit and groped around. Nothing. He pushed his arm in up past the elbow, ignoring the slime that oozed all over his skin. He pulled out a lump of something and wiped it against his other arm. It was the key.
Amazing. A miracle. We aren't going to die down here after all, Nash. Now let's get to the bottom and untie Finn's body. Then we can try to climb back up. They might even be able to pull us up.
As it turned out, they were close to the bottom, or at least another ledge. There was a steam vent nearby that billowed acrid smoke over them, obscuring everything below and killing the luminescent algae, so Logan couldn't see far enough to tell where they were, if, indeed, such a question had any meaning in hell. Nasher stepped away from the rope, spreading his fingers out to ease the pain in them. Logan put his feet back on semi-solid ground. Logan hadn't held nearly as much weight as Nasher had, but he was still exhausted. Then he saw the rope. It was loose.
Nasher? How long has there been slack in the rope?
Nasher blinked at him. The question didn't mean anything to the simpleton.
Nash! Finn's alive! He could be...
Finn more fell than jumped on top of him. The convict moved like he dislocated his hip, and he was bleeding from his head and his mouth, both shoulders and one leg. In his right hand, he held the broken, bloodied tip of a stalagmite. Finn's sharp rock bit into his chest, gashed open his forearm as he tried to block, cut from his forehead past his ear. Logan tried to throw Finn off the ledge, but he was too weak. He knocked Finn off of Logan and bit his nose, rising a moment later with a bloody chunk in his filed teeth. Before he could scream again, Nasher grabbed Finn's dislocated leg, pulling him away from Logan. Finn reached out, tried to grab anything to get away from Nasher. Then, Finn's body caught between two stalagmites. Nasher either didn't see or didn't care. He had decided to pull Finn away from Logan, and that was what he was going to do. Nasher stumbled and fell as he ripped Finn's leg off and sent it sailing into the abyss.
See, you were in hell, King.
I've already done my time. I found the key. I'm leaving.
Finn's eyes flared with hatred and disbelief, but he didn't have the strength to speak.
Nash, you are amazing. Thank you.
Nasher's bloody toothed smile was a truly terrible sight, but he meant well. Logan was bleeding pretty badly. He didn't know if he'd make it, even if they ran into no problems getting out of the hole and out of the maw. But there was no reason for Nash to die too, or Lily. And Nash wouldn't climb the rope without him. He knew that.
All right, Nash.
You're strong. Are you strong enough to climb out of here?
Nasher liked being called strong.
Then let's get out of this hell.
But even as Logan grabbed the rope, he felt a slackness in it. A moment later, the entire length of the sinew rope fell around them. There would be no climbing out. There would be no using the precious key. There would be no escape. The holers had dropped the rope.
Where the hell are they?
The holers barely recognized Tensor Vargen in his fine tunic with his face shaved and his hair washed.
Where do you think they are? They escaped!
They escaped? Impossible!
No shit!
Tensor flushed, embarrassed in front of Nefdata and the guards accompanying him.
Illuminatus!
Magical light bloomed in the hole, illuminating everyone. It even dipped to the cutout where Logan had so frequently hid. There was no one there.
Logan, Finn, and Nasher. Logan and Finn hated each other. What happened?
King won't...
Shut up, bitch. I don't trust you. You, Tats, what happened?
Logan wanted to build another pyramid. He wanted to attract Gorky and see if he could grab his legs and get the key off him. Finn wouldn't go for it. They fought. Finn threw Logan in the hole, but then Nasher attacked him, and all of them fell in.
Why didn't you stop them?
And fall in myself? Anyone who's tangled with Finn or Logan or Nash gets killed, buddy. Your Highness, you were down here long enough to know that.
Could they have survived the fall? Let it return.
A bright ball of magical light stuck one of the holer's chests and another to his back and lifted him over the hole. Then he fell. Everyone crowded around the hole, watching the light disappear into the darkness.
5, 6, 7.
The light winked out right before 8.
No, then. Well, I can't say your father will be pleased.
Fuck! Take them, Nef. Kill them. Do whatever you do, but make it painful.
Hugh Gibbet crouched on the roof of a warehouse deep in the Warrens. In a more prosperous time, it had been used to store textiles. Later, smugglers had used it. Now it was a crumbling ruin that housed guild rats of the Burning Man Guild. None of that mattered to Hugh, except for the inconvenience of having to kill the 10-year-old boy who was standing guard. Or maybe it had been a girl, hard to tell. The only thing that mattered to Hugh was a slab of stone on the floor by one crumbled wall. It looked like it weighed 1,000 pounds, and it was as weathered as all the other stones, but it opened on hinges that not even the guild rats knew about. It was the second exit for one of the largest safe houses in the city. Right now, if Hugh's source was correct, the safe house held approximately 300 whores, enough food and water to keep them for a month, and the real prizes, Mama Kay and her lieutenant, Brant Agon. Hugh didn't expect those two to be here, not really, but he could always hope. He always had trouble with the big jobs. A big job required such balance. The pleasure in so much blood threatened his professionalism. It was so easy to get caught up in the sheer joy of it, watching blood spill or dribble or spurt. Blood in all its glorious hues. The red, red blood fresh from the lungs, the black blood from the liver, and every shade in between. He wanted to bleed everybody dry to please Nisos, but on the big jobs, he couldn't usually take the time. It made him feel like he was doing things halfway. Plus, it always left him depressed. After he'd killed and bled 30 or 32 at the Geyer estate, he hadn't been the same for weeks. Even all the killing during the coup couldn't satisfy him. It was all a letdown. The Geyer estate had been the best. He'd still been in the estate when the Duke got home. He'd watched Regnus Geyer run from room to room, mad with grief, slipping in the Nisos pools Hugh had left in every hall. He'd been so excited by watching that, he couldn't even kill the Duke, though he knew the God King wished it. He'd finished that job the next night, of course, But that had been nothing. Not even close. This job wouldn't be too hard. There would be some tight moments early on. First, he had to get in. He'd kill the children if he had to, but guild rats were slippery. They knew every hole in the Warrens the size of a walnut and could fit into it with room to spare. It would be better not to give them the chance to warn anyone. After he got in, there would be a guard or two in the back exit. It was an exit that had never been used, and there was only so long a man could stare at a wall before he got bored and tired, so the guards there might well be asleep. Then Hugh would need to kill the guards at the front exit without raising an alarm. Then he'd have to block or destroy the fire exit. After that point, it wouldn't matter if the whores found out he was there or not. He could handle whores. Then, well, the God King had told him that he had 24 hours to do whatever he wanted.
You make me a cataclysm.
The God King planned to open up the place afterward and march every noble in the city through it. When the bodies were starting to get ripe, they'd start marching the rest of the city through it. The residents of the Warrens would go last. Then, the God King would have a public ceremony. People selected at random from among the rabbits, the artisans, and the nobility would be sent into the massacre site. While they were inside, the God King's witches would seal the exits. Garoth Ursul expected it would provide a forceful deterrent to future rebellion. But Hugh felt uneasy. He was a professional. He was the best wet boy in the city, the best in the world, the best ever. He treasured that position, and there was only one thing that could threaten it. Himself. He'd taken stupid risks at the Geyer estate, idiotic risks. It had all worked out, but the fact remained that he'd been out of control. There had just been too much blood, too much thrill. He'd walked like a god through an orgy of worship that was death. He'd felt invulnerable during the hours he'd butchered the Geyers and their servants. He'd spent time displaying the bodies. He'd hung up several by their feet and cut their throats to bleed them to create that glorious lake of blood in the last hallway. His job was to kill, and he'd gone dangerously beyond that. Durzo had been a killer. He took lives with the impersonal precision of a tailor. Durzo Blint would never have put himself at risk. It was why some people had considered him Hugh's equal. Hugh hated that. He was feared, but Blint was respected. His niggling worry was that the judgment was deserved. That was why 300 might be his undoing. The beast within would come out. 300 might be too much. No, he was Hugh Gibbet. Nothing was too much for Hugh Gibbet. He was the best wet boy in the world. Tactically, this job wouldn't be nearly the challenge some others had been. But when people whispered his name, this would be what they remembered. This would be his legacy. They would remember this all over the world. The guild rats were all asleep, huddled together in clumps against the cold. He was about to drop through the hole in the roof when he saw something. At first, he thought he was imagining it. It began as a whisper of wind, a puff of dust scattered in the moonlight. But the dust didn't settle, and there was no wind tonight. Still, the dust seemed to swirl in one place, gathering in one of the patches of moonlight in the warehouse near the children. And in a second, every child in the guild was awake. The whirlwind became a tiny tornado. Though there was still no wind, something was taking shape. Black specks obscuring and spinning in a dizzying pace to a height of 6 feet. Taking shape through the tornado was a man, or something like a man. The figure flashed blue, spraying light in every direction, and not even Hugh was fast enough to cover his eyes. When he looked again, a figure unlike any he had ever seen stood before the children, who were cowering wide-eyed on the floor. The man appeared to be carved from glossy black marble or shaped from liquid metal. His clothes weren't so much clothes as skin. Though he appeared to wear shoes and was sexless, his whole body was unrelieved black and every contour was crisply defined. He was lean, and every muscle was etched from his shoulders to his V of a chest, to his stomach, to his legs. Most frightening was the demon's face. It looked even less human than the rest of it. The mouth a small gash, cheekbones high, hair a disheveled spiky black, brows prominent and disapproving above overlarge eyes out of a nightmare. The eyes were the palest blue of the coldest winter dawn. They spoke of judgment without pity, of judgment without remorse. As the figure studied the children, Hugh became more and more certain that the eyes were actually glowing. Wisps of smoke curled out from them, from whatever infernal fires burned within that hellish figure.
Children, be not afraid. I will not harm you. But you're not safe here. You must go to Guinevere Kyrena, the one you know as Mama Kay. Go and stay with her. Tell her the Night Angel has returned.
Several children nodded, wide-eyed, but they all seemed frozen to the ground.
Go!
He stepped forward through a shadow that cut the moonlight on the warehouse floor, and an eerie thing happened. Where the shadow cut across the Night Angel, the demon disappeared. An arm, a diagonal slash of body, and his head disappeared, except for two glowing spots that hung in space where his eyes should be.
Run!
The children bolted like only guild rats can. Hugh knew that he should kill this Night Angel. Surely the God King would reward him. Besides, the demon blocked Hugh's entrance to his assignment. The Night Angel stood between him and more than 300 succulent kills. But it was hard to breathe. He wasn't afraid. It was simply that he didn't do jobs for free. He'd kill this angel, but he'd leave for now, making the God King pay him for it. It was completely logical. Fear had nothing to do with it. Night Angel turned his face up, and his eyes locked on Hugh Gibbons.
Dost thou desire thy judgment this night, Hubert Marion?
Cold dread paralyzed him. Hubert Marion. No one had called him that in 15 years. The Night Angel was unmoving toward him. Hugh was on the verge of fleeing when the Night Angel stumbled. He stopped, puzzled. The ruby eyes dimmed, flickered. The Night Angel sagged. Hugh dropped to the floor and drew his sword. The Night Angel drew itself up once more by an act of will, but Hugh read exhaustion there. The swords rang in the night. Then Hugh's kick blew through a block and connected with the Night Angel's chest. The creature flew back, its sword flying from its hand. It landed in a heap and began to shimmer. In moments, the Night Angel was gone. In its place lay a man, naked, barely conscious. It was Kyler Stern, Durzo's apprentice.
Oh, motherfucker!
Hugh's fear bled into outrage. It was all tricks? Illusions? Hugh stomped forward and slashed at Kyler's exposed neck. But his blade went completely through the man's head without resistance, shattering the illusion. Hugh had barely stopped the slash when he felt a rope tighten around his ankles and yank him off his feet. Fingers dug into his right elbow, hitting the pressure point and enervating his arm. A hand grabbed his hair and smacked his face against the floor again and again. On the third time, Hugh's descending face came down on a rock. It ripped into his eye. Then his arms were behind his back, and with a swift jerk upward, both shoulders were dislocated. When he next thought to thrash, he found his arms and legs tied together. From his remaining eye, Hugh caught sight of Kyler Stern, wobbling, clearly exhausted, but still pulling Hugh across the floor by his cloak. Kyler dropped him on his back. Kyler stood over him. Whatever the black skin had been, illusion or something else, Kyler obviously didn't have the power to hold it now. He stood naked, but his face was as much of a mask as the mask had been. Hugh gathered his talent to try another kick. Kyla's foot streaked down first, breaking Hugh's shin. When Hugh looked again, Kyla was kicking a section of the floor. Inside, a hidden water wheel turned, driven by the flowing waters of the Plith River. Hugh realized it must be the mechanism that opened the huge door of the safe house, its mighty gears currently disengaged, spinning slowly.
Nisus is the god of waters, right?
Oh, what are you doing?
Pray. Maybe he'll save you.
Kylo did something with Hugh's cloak. For a moment, nothing happened. Then the cloak tightened around his neck. It started dragging him across the floor.
Nice house! Nice house!
The cloak pulled him into the water, and for a long, blessed moment, the tension around his neck vanished. He kicked his good leg and found the surface. Then the cloak tightened and drew him into the gear. The disengaged gear pulled him out of the water by his throat and then flipped him over, dragging him back under the water again. He tried to fight his bonds, but any pressure he put on his shoulders was agony. His arms were tied so tightly he couldn't pop his shoulders back into their joints, and his good leg kicked against nothing but water. Swaying on his feet, Kylo looked for the switch to open the safe house. He hadn't been faking his exhaustion. He was just lucky that he'd had enough talent left to fool Hugh. In a fair fight, Hugh would have taken it. Kylo had no illusions about that. But Durzo had taught him there was no such thing as a fair fight. Finally, Kylo found what he was looking for. He grabbed a plank beside the rock and pulled it up. The spinning gear slid sideways until its teeth met another gear's. Hugh was pulled inexorably out of the water one more time.
Oh no!
His head caught between the great teeth of the gears. The enormous rock lifted, revealing a tunnel into the earth. In moments, a pair of guards thundered up the steps, spears in their hands.
Half, two, evacuate. God King Nusha here. Tell Mama Kay.
Then he passed out. Fir Kasat huddled as much of his bulk behind a tree as he could. It was 2 hours before dawn, and the figure lying beside the fire had been still for hours. In just a few moments, Fir would know whether all his gambles had paid off. His search for Kurak had taken him to Sanaria, through the camps of the Caladoran Highlanders, and into the mountains on the Karan border. His hope and his despair for weeks had been that he hadn't even heard a whisper of a special sword. That meant if he was on the right track, Kurak might be held by a man who had no idea what it was. That scenario was vastly preferable to the idea of trying to take it from a Würdmeister. Any Würdmeister with the ability to use Kurak would have the ability to kill Fir 100 ways. What was more likely was that he was on the wrong track. He'd made a dozen guesses as he'd narrowed his list of possibilities. First, he'd taken a Caladoran uniform and stitched messenger's insignia on it and sat at lots of campfires. When they'd been in school, Dorian had taught him Caladoran. So even when the conversation lapsed into the old tongue, all young Caladorans were bilingual, the God King thought they could better rule if they knew the schemes of those they conquered. He knew what they were saying. Because they hadn't immediately found Kurak, and Fir guessed rumors would have spread about that if they had, he figured someone must have taken the sword. He found the units that had done the cleanup detail on the bridge. Most of the men had been from units nearly destroyed in the fighting. Later, they'd been lumped into a new unit and sent home guarding the wagons taking loot back to Kalidor, the very wagon train he and Dorian and Solon had been following. Because Dorian had sent him south, Fir knew that the sword hadn't gone with the baggage train. So he'd asked after anyone from those units who hadn't gone home, and he'd found one. Finding where Ferl Kallius had gone was an entirely different matter. In fact, Fear had never found the man. Instead, he'd found a Würdmeister who had been sent south. The Würdmeister tracked Ferl Kallius, and Fear tracked the Würdmeister. He'd watched the Würdmeister throw missiles at Ferl Kallius and the lord he'd kidnapped. The Würdmeister lost interest as soon as the lord fell from the heights of Mount Hezeron. While the Würdmeister used his signal stick to tell the God King of his failure, Fear had crept close. The falling snow and the concentration required to work magic had covered Fear's approach. As soon as the Würdmeister was finished, Fear killed him. Then he'd done something he would never do again. He'd crossed the broken ledge in the snow. He'd jumped across a 5-foot gap from slick snow to slick snow. There had been places steep enough that his feet slid back as far as he climbed. He'd ended up using magic to melt some of the ice just long enough to take a few more steps. He'd made it, but it had been close. Korok was worth it. He drew his sword and stepped forward in a modified shell posto, a fighter's stance for keeping balance and agility on slick ground. In a few quick steps, he was over the man. His sword dipped and stabbed through the figure's chest, a chest made of snow wrapped in a cloak. Fear whipped around as the real Ferl Kallius charged out of the woods. Korok held high. Fear barely had time to move. Korok knocked the blade from his hand.
Not much honor in stabbing a sleeping man.
The stakes are too high for honor. Give me the sword and I'll let you live.
This is a war chief's sword.
A war chief? That sword is worth more than your entire clan and every other clan for 100 miles put together.
It's mine!
You can't do it!
3 points of white light, each smaller than Fear's thumbnail, appeared before him and whizzed at Ferl Kallius. The two missiles that Ferl blocked with his sword blasted off into the night. The third missile went right below Ferl's hands into his belly. Fear reached out with difficulty and yanked the missile up. It burned a path to Ferl's heart. Fear picked up Korok without elation. He'd been right. All his guesses and gambles had paid off. If anyone ever heard this story, the bards would make it a legend. He'd just recovered one of the most powerful magical artifacts ever created. So why did he feel empty? It had been so easy this time. Slow, but easy. Maybe Ferl had been right. It hadn't been honorable, but when one person had Korok, the fight was never fair. But that wasn't it either. He'd recovered this damn sword 3 times. 3! He could be declared the official finder of the blasted sword. He had it, but he could never use it. He was mediocre, and he'd made the mistake of being friends with the great. Solanarawan Tofusen Safasti had been a prince of the Sethi Empire. His talent put him in the top ranks of all living mages. Dorian was another prince, a Würdmeister, and more. He was a magus of the kind that came along once a generation. Fear was a Cordwainer's son, with middling talent and a good hand with a sword. He'd been an apprentice smith when his talent had been discovered, and he'd later attended the Maker's School, and then been hired as a smith and blades instructor at Shokendi, where he'd met Solon and Dorian. Dorian had disavowed his birth, and neither he nor Solon had been officially granted any special treatment. But that, Fear knew, didn't mean they'd gotten no benefit from their noble birth. No matter what happened to Dorian or Solon, they knew that they were something special. They knew they mattered. Fear never had. He was always second place, if not third. The signal stick flashed and Fear pulled it out. The young Würdmeister he'd killed had kept a translation key on him. Evidently, it had been the first time he'd been entrusted with a signal stick, so Fear had been able to translate the flashes of light into letters, but they were still in code, and in Kalidoran. Breaking that code was simple. The first letter was its Kalidoran letter plus one. The second was the letter plus two, and so on. But the letters were spelled out rapidly, and Fear had nothing to write on, and his Kalidoran vocabulary was limited. The God King was using them exactly the way Fear had. He was coordinating distant troops and Meisters. It was simple and yet an enormous advantage. His commands were delivered instantly, while his opponents had to wait hours or days for messengers. In those days or hours, situations changed, plans changed. No wonder he's devastated every army to come against him. The signal stick flashed, then it paused and the blue modified to red. What the hell did that mean? Fear spelled out the letters, and on a hunch transliterated them into common.
P-A-V-V-I-L-S-G-R-O-V-E. Pavel Skrov.
It turned blue and went too rapidly for Fear to catch, but it repeated one section twice.
2 days. 2 days.
Then it went dark. Fear had passed through Pavel's Grove on his way south. It was a small logging town that produced some of Scenario's only oak. There was a plain north of the town suitable for a battle. Clearly, the God King had a plan to wipe out the rebel army there. Fear could get there in 2 days, but it was still 2 hours until dawn. Did the Caladorans count a day from dawn or from midnight? Did 2 days mean 2 or 3?
Damn it!
He could break an obscure cipher in another language, but he couldn't count to 3.
Oh, great!
The signal stick turned yellow, something it had never done before.
Lord Meister Lawrence, report!
Oh, no!
Why? Going south?
Fear blanched. So the signal sticks didn't just communicate, they transmitted his position. That wasn't good.
Punishment will... when you return.
My punishment will be decided when I return.
Lantano, rumored to be near you. Any sign?
Fear wanted to grab his own ignorance by the neck and shake the life out of it. What was rumored to be near him?
Lord Meister Lores.
Fear threw the stick away and scurried backward. Nothing happened. A minute passed. Still nothing happened.
Well, that'll wake the neighbors. Lantano.
The name sounded familiar. Fear climbed a rock hill nearby to get a better view of his surroundings. He almost wished he hadn't. 400 paces to the south, an army was camped, with perhaps 6,000 men. The usual camp followers added perhaps 4,000 to that. Wives and farriers and smiths and prostitutes and cooks and servants. The army's flags bore a stark black vertical sword on a white field. Lantano Gurawashi's Seagull. That was the name Fear remembered. A general who'd never been defeated. A commoner's son who had won 60 duels. If the stories were to be believed, sometimes he fought with wood practice swords against his opponent's steel to make things interesting. The neighbors had definitely heard the noise. And a knot of 10 horsemen was riding toward Fear right now. At least 100 others followed. Kyler opened his eyes in an unfamiliar room. It was getting to be an all too common occurrence. This rendition was small, dirty, cramped. The bed smelled as if the straw hadn't been changed in 20 years. His heart raced as he prepared himself for whatever might come next.
Relax.
Mama Kay was standing near his bed. It was a safe house, doubtless, on the north side of the Warrens by the smell.
How long? How long have I been out?
Nice to see you, too.
A day and a half.
Kyla sat up. The speaker was Lord General Agon. That was a surprise.
Well, looks like the huge new wall around the city isn't the only thing that's changed.
Amazing what the bastards can do when they try something constructive, isn't it?
It's good to see you, Kyla. The rumors have already started about how the Night Angel killed Hugh Gibbet. But the only people who know that it was actually you are my guards. They've been with me a long time. They won't speak.
What do you know about Logan?
He's dead.
He's not dead.
The best information we have...
Jarl came to tell me, all the way to Caernarvon.
Kyla, The Kalidorans found out who Logan was yesterday. As best we can tell, he either was killed by another inmate because of it, or he threw himself down the hole to avoid what the God King would do to him.
I don't believe it.
I'm sorry.
Kyler stood and found a new set of wet boy grays piled on the foot of the bed. He began getting dressed.
Kyler!
Son, it's time to open your eyes. No one likes that Logan's dead. He was like a son to me. You can't bring him back, but you can do some things that no one else can.
And let me guess. You two already have some ways you want to put my talents to use.
In a few days, Terra Grayson's army will meet the God King's army just north of Pavel's Grove. She'll get there first and have the advantage both of terrain and numbers.
And the problem is?
That the God King's going for it. After the Nocta Hemata, he should be twice as careful as he ever has been, but he's walking straight into this. Kyler, our spies have only caught hints, but I'm sure this is a trap. Terra Grayson won't listen. She wouldn't fight until the God King presented her with a fight she couldn't lose. Now she has that, and nothing will stop her. All we know is that he's doing something magical, and it's big.
Don't say it.
We want to hide for a hit, Kyler. A hit worthy of the Night Angel. We want you to kill the God King.
You're insane.
You'll be a legend.
I'd rather be alive.
Even if Logan is still alive, it won't be any good to save his life if you let his only chance to have a kingdom be destroyed. If he survived this long, he can make it for another day or two. Kill the God King and save the kingdom, then go looking for our king.
Kyla selected weapons from the wide array Mama Kay had prepared for him and secreted them about himself.
You'll doom us all. You have the kind of power I'd die for, and you won't use it to help us. Damn you!
Agon turned on his heel and hobbled out of the room. Kyla looked at Mama Kay. She didn't leave, but she didn't understand either.
It's good to see you again, too, Mama. I left Yuli with Eline. They're both going to be all right. I left them with enough money that they'll be taken care of for the rest of their lives. And Eline will love her. I did the best I could. Jarl.
Mama Kay put a hand on Kyler's arm, and he looked down.
I know it doesn't make sense. But I swore to leave this behind me. I broke that vow for Logan. That cost me Eline's love and Yuli's trust. I didn't abandon them so I could steal another life, but so I could save a life. Do you understand?
Do you know who you remind me of? Durzo. When he was younger, before he lost his way. He would be proud of you, Kyler. I'm proud of you, too. I wish I could believe that the fates wouldn't be so cruel as to make you sacrifice everything just to find Logan dead. But I don't have that kind of faith. But I tell you what I do believe in. I believe in you.
You're different.
It's all your fault. Next I'll go senile.
I like it.
Go, Kyla. Go. And please, do come back.
Logan had fallen asleep twice now, each time expecting that he wouldn't wake up. He had stopped eating. He wouldn't touch Finn's body. He had stopped smelling the thick, corrosive air. He had stopped noticing Nash's little mews of concern. He had stopped bleeding, too. But it was too late. He had no strength. After Nasher had helped him sit up against a stalagmite, Logan saw another crushed body lying broken in the gloom not 10 feet away. It was Natasa Grayson. The screams of the howlers didn't frighten her now. Her limbs were mangled, but her face looked at peace. Her eyes held no accusation. They held nothing. The most passion Logan could wake was simple regret. He was sorry for Natasa, who'd never even told him how she ended up down here. He was sorry for all the things he would never do. He had never truly desired the throne. He'd always suspected that being a king was far harder than it looked. In the whole, he'd sometimes regretted that he wouldn't be remembered as someone who mattered. Now, as he sat with his back propped against the stalagmite that would someday flow over his body and entomb him for eternity. He wished for simpler things. He missed sunlight. He missed the smell of grass, of fresh rain, of a woman. He missed Sarah Drake and all her trivialities. He missed his wife. Janine was so young, so smart, so pretty. She had been a diamond found and then lost forever. He missed Kyler, his best friend. Another diamond stripped away, found, and lost. Logan wished for love and children and the running of his estates. A simple life. A big family, a few close friends that would give him all the immortality he needed. For a while, he prayed to the old gods. There was nothing else to do, and Nasha wasn't much for conversation, but the old gods had nothing to say. He even prayed to Count Drake's one god. He wasn't sure how one was supposed to pray to the god of all things. Why would he care? Logan gave it up. Mostly, he tried to ignore the pain. He was about to close his eyes to try to die again or sleep. The vent belched acrid smoke, and the figure Logan glimpsed for an instant was devoured in the thick cloud and darkness. Then, as the cloud dissipated, a demon strode out of it. For the first time Logan had ever seen, Nasha showed fear. He retreated to Logan's side and crouched, but that was as far as he would retreat. The simple man's loyalty knew no bounds. The demon walked forward slowly, its glowing blue eyes fixed on Logan. This was a howler? Or was this death finally come to claim him? Logan wasn't afraid.
Well, shit, man. Thought I was going to have to climb all the way up the hill to find you.
What are you?
The demon's face shimmered and melted off of Kyler's face. Logan was sure he'd finally gone crazy.
Sorry, I forgot about the face. You, look like the south end of a northbound horse.
Is, big guy here going to be all right?
Nash, he's a friend. He's here to help.
Nash's expression didn't change, but he didn't move to attack.
It really is you, isn't it?
Here to save the day.
When Logan failed to respond, Kyler came over and checked Logan's body. The expression on his face grew grim.
Well, what's one more miracle, huh? You're still kicking.
Logan felt himself drifting away from consciousness as Kyler helped him to his feet. Kyler was speaking, and part of Logan realized that he was just trying to keep Logan with him. He did his best to listen to Kyler's voice and ignore the voices of pain and death calling to him.
Because it's damn near impossible to get into the mall now. Not like the old days. They say someone or something has taken up residence. I mean, residence like the mall's a palace or something.
Golly.
Kyler took them deeper into the hole. Logan stumbled again, and when he opened his eyes, he found that he was lashed to Kyler's back. That couldn't be right. Even with all the weight Logan had lost, Kyler shouldn't have been able to carry him this easily. But the sensation didn't fade. Kyler was picking his way farther and farther down. There was no path and no luminous moss down here, but Kyler moved surely and kept talking, his voice itself warding off Logan's terror of the dark.
I was in the stacks once, and I remembered how the pipes seemed to go down into the very center of the earth. I figured that the moor goes down and the stacks pipes go down, and then they're right next to each other. I thought that if I went deep enough, the tunnels might connect. You ever seen the inside of those pipes in the stacks, Logan? Sheer metal going straight down, just about forever. Big windmill blades spinning as they catch the rising air. I figured I could take the slow way down or the fast way. You know me, you can guess which I took. I grabbed a shield, made myself a little sled with handbrakes so I could steer a little. I tell you, it was a hell of a ride. I almost made it all the way down, too. Good thing I'd lost most of my speed before that last fan. I'm sure it was turning faster. I pity the poor bastards who will have to climb down to fix it.
Then Kyler stopped.
I'm not going to lie to you. This is the bad part. We have to go underwater. This is the line, Logan. This is what separates the hole from the stacks. The water's hot, and it's tight, and it's going to feel like you've been buried. I promise you, if you can make it through this death, you'll come out into a new life. You just hold your breath, and I'll do all the work.
Nasha?
Nasha, Oh, the big guy. He doesn't look like he likes water much, Logan.
Logan couldn't see Nasher. It was just dark down here. It was utterly black. There wasn't even lighter blackness. It was a single, unalleviated, embracing darkness. It was hot, wet, heavy, oppressive darkness that seeped into his very lungs. He had no idea how Kyla was seeing Nasher, but Logan wouldn't leave him here.
Will you come back and get him?
There was a long silence.
Yes, my king.
I'm ready.
You just count. I got through in about a minute. It might take us a little longer together.
A minute?
Before we go, I'm sorry, Logan. I am sorry for all this and for how much of it's my fault. I'm sorry I didn't tell you what I was. I'm sorry that I didn't kill Tensa when I had the chance. I'm just sorry.
Logan said nothing. He couldn't find the words and the strength to give Kyla what he deserved. Kyla didn't wait. Logan leaned close to Kyla's body, trying not to get in the way of his arms, trying to make his body streamlined in the water. The water was hot, stinging hot, and clearly Kyla didn't mean for this to be a leisurely swim. Logan felt them turn upside down, and then Kyla must have been grabbing onto rocks to pull them down because they were moving fast. In fact, they were moving faster than Logan thought was possible underwater. He knew Kyla was strong. He'd wrestled and sparred with him, but the speed they were moving shouldn't have been possible with the mass Kyla was pulling through the water. 10, 11. The water was pressing on every side, tight and constricting. Some part of Logan marveled that Kyler had done this already, alone, without any sure idea that the tunnels did connect or how long of a swim it would be. At 14 seconds, Logan's lungs were already burning. He held on, trying not to hold on too hard, trying to preserve his strength. The pain was nothing, he told himself. It was 20 seconds before he felt them level off. His back scraped against rock. It felt different, though he couldn't have said what sense told him so. He thought they had entered a tunnel, and from how Kyla was moving, it was a narrow tunnel. 40. 41. Now the pain was undeniable. The air was pressing its way up his throat, begging for release. It hammered at him. Just a little release. Just a little. At 50, they got stuck. Abruptly, all forward motion ceased. The shock of it made Logan open his eyes. Hot, sour water attacked his eyes. An enormous bubble of life-giving air rushed from his lungs. Kyla pulled and pulled. Logan felt something tearing. Whether it was his ragged tunic or his skin, he didn't know, but then they were moving again. He had less than half a lung full of air. Kyla was moving at incredible speed again, but they still weren't heading upward. Then Logan felt Kyla turn, but his friend didn't push upward. Instead, in a frenzied motion illuminated with blue magical light, he drew a short sword from his belt. Logan was thrown this way and that as Kyla slashed and stabbed at something, something flashing like silver lightning in the water. There was no way he could take any more. Kyla started moving upward, but Logan couldn't make it for another 20 seconds. He couldn't hold on that long. At 67 seconds, he let the last of his air go. They were moving up so fast he felt it play against his face as they shot up. They passed the bubble. His lungs burned. He surrendered and breathed. Kyler untied him and lowered him gently to the ground. Logan lay on his back, just breathing. It was still dark, but high overhead, up the metal tubes, up the stacks, he saw the twinkle of distant torches. After the black waters, it felt like stepping into a universe of light.
There's something in the water. Some giant, terrible lizard. If I go back, I don't know if I'll return. You're in no shape to make it out alone. Without me, you'll die here. Do you still want me to retrieve the simpleton?
Logan wanted to say no. He was more important to the kingdom than Nasher, and he was afraid to be left alone. Life was suddenly so close, and he didn't want to die.
I can't abandon him, Kyla. Forgive me.
You'd only need forgiveness if you'd asked me to leave him.
Kyla was gone for 5 agonizing minutes. When he broke the surface of the water, he was swimming at such great speed that it carried him into the air. He landed on his feet. He'd made a harness of the rope and had pulled Nasha behind him. Now he grabbed the rope and pulled it in rapidly. Nasha virtually flew clear of the water.
Hold breath, good.
Kyla swept Logan into his arms as something huge broke through the water behind them. Something slapped into Kyla and sent all three of them sprawling. Then the chamber was lit with iridescent blue light that came from Kyla himself. He was darting about, flipping from stalagmite to stalagmite, using them to change direction unpredictably. Logan had no idea how Kyla was fighting it at all in this pitch black, and no hope of fighting it for himself. He didn't even know how big it was, or what it looked like. He lost sight of Kyla, or Kyla disappeared. Suddenly, it shot toward Logan and Nasha. Logan threw his hands out and felt slimy hide rush past his fingers. Stalagmites crashed down everywhere. Then it pulled back and turned its head. A light as silvery cold as the moon bloomed in its green marbled eyes, and then the great snuffling head turned. The slimy snout slid past Logan's cheek as the beast's head turned. Logan's fingers brushed a broken chunk of stalagmite and he grabbed it. The motion attracted the creature. It pulled back and the light from its eye illuminated Logan like torchlight. The great cat's eye turned to him and came into focus. Logan buried the jagged rock into that great eye and ground it back and forth. Luminous green silver light spilled on Logan with the creature's blood. The eye went out like a blown candle. A moment later, a dark figure blurred past Logan and attacked the blind eye.
Oh, Logan, was that Kali?
No. Kali's different. Worse. That was just a dragon.
And all light faded. When he woke, the three of them had been fitted with harnesses, and Kyla was hoisting them all by a rope that must have been attached to a pulley high above. They were ascending the central shaft of the stacks. It was a huge metal tube, 30 paces across, and all of the enormous fans had been stopped. How did Kyla manage that? The trip took several more minutes, and the whole time, Logan was aware of his arm burning and tingling where the creature's eye blood had spilled on him. He didn't have the courage to look at it.
We have a man inside who helped me. The Sakage is now one of your most important allies, my king. Maybe your only ally.
A few minutes later, they reached a section where the pipes turned horizontal. With great care, Kyla untied Logan and then Nasha. He cut the ropes and let them fall into the abyss. The pulley followed. He led them down the narrowing horizontal section until they reached a door. Logan found himself face to face with Gorky.
Logan, meet our inside guy. Gorky, your money?
You!
Kill him.
Gorky's eyes bulged. He grabbed at the guard's whistle he carried on a lanyard around his neck. It was that fast. That easy. Kyler dragged the body down the tunnel to drop it into the shaft and returned a minute later. Logan had just ordered his first kill. Kyler didn't ask for an explanation. It was an eerie, awesome, awful thing. It was power, and it felt disconcertingly wonderful.
Your Majesty, your kingdom awaits.
When Caldrosa Wynn and 10 of the other girls from the Craven Dragon emerged from Mama Kay's safe house, the Warrens were changed. There was a nervous excitement in the air. The Nocta Hamata had been a triumph, but repercussions were coming. Everyone knew it. Mama Kay had told the girls they needed to leave her subterranean safe house because the secret of its existence had leaked. Somehow, the Night Angel had saved them all from being slaughtered by Hugh Gibbet. Caldrosa had heard rumors of the Night Angel before, right after the invasion, but she hadn't believed them. Now, they all knew he was real. They'd seen Hugh Gibbet's body. Mama Kay had told them she would smuggle them out as quickly as possible, but moving 300 women out of the city was going to take time. They had ways to get around or under the God King's new walls, but it wasn't easy. Caldrosa Wynn's group was supposed to go out tonight. Mama Kay had told them that if they wanted to stay in the city, if they had husbands or boyfriends or family to go back to, all they had to do was not show up at the rendezvous tonight. The Warrens were quiet, expectant, as the women made their way to the safe house. They were conspicuous, of course, all of them still dressed in their rich whoring clothes. Master Picun's design seemed obscene in the broad daylight, in the context of open streets. Worse, some of the girls' costumes were stained with brown-black smears of dried blood. But the women passed no guards, and it was soon clear that the Caladorans didn't go into the Warrens now. The residents who saw them looked at them strangely. One alley they tried to traverse was blocked by a building that must have been knocked down during the Nocta Hamata itself, and it forced Caldrosa Wynn and the others to walk straight through the Durden Market. The market was busy, but the former whores passed through it. A wave of silence preceded them. Every eye was on them. The girls set their jaws ready for the derision their clothing would surely evoke. But nothing happened. A stout fishwife leaned over her stall.
You don't know sprout, girls!
The women were caught off guard. The approval hit them like a slap in the face. Everywhere it was the same. People everywhere nodded in greeting and acceptance. Even the women who, a week ago, would have sneered at rent girls even as they envied their good looks and easy lives. Even as the rabbits waited for the God King to crush them, as they knew he must. They shared a unity forged of persecution. The rabbits had surprised themselves with their own bravery that night, and somehow the whores bore their standard. The gloriously solitary two-day ride to Sanaria had only one problem. There was no irritating child, no domineering hag, no verbal sparring, no humiliation. But the time gave V an opportunity to see how flimsy her plans were. The first plan was to go to the God King. It had seemed great for about 5 minutes. She'd tell him that Kyla was dead. She'd tell him Jarl was dead. She'd ask for her gold, and she'd leave.
Right.
Sister Ariel's musings about the spell on V were far too specific to be guesses. V would either have a short leash or a long leash, but she'd have a leash. Gareth Ursul had promised to break her. It wasn't the kind of promise he'd forget. In truth, V felt broken already. She was losing her edge. It was one thing to feel bad for killing Jarl. Jarl had kept her alive. He'd been a friend and someone who would never demand the use of her body. He hadn't been a threat, physically or sexually. Kyla was a different matter altogether. And yet even now, riding slowly through the streets of Sanaria, her hood close around her face, V couldn't stop thinking about him. She was actually sorry he was dead. Maybe even sad. Kyler had been a damn good wet boy, one of the best. It was a shame he'd been killed with an arrow, probably from hiding. Not even a wet boy could stop that.
That's it. Could happen to anyone. Makes me realize my own mortality. It's just a shame.
It wasn't just a shame. That wasn't what she felt, and she knew it. Kyler had been kind of cute. If you could think kind of cute with a mental sneer, kind of charming, Well, not that charming, but he did try. Really, it was Yuli's fault. Yuli had talked and talked about how great he was. Fuck. So maybe she'd entertained a whim that Kyla could be the kind of man who could understand her. He'd been a wet boy, and somehow he'd left it and become a decent person. If he could do it, maybe she could too. Yes, he was a wet boy, but he was never a whore.
You think he could understand that? Forgive it? Sure. You go ahead with your little crush, V. Ball your eyes out like a little girl. Go ahead and pretend you could have been an Aline, making a little home and having a little life. I'm sure it would have been a great fun to suckle brats and crochet baby blankets. The truth is, you didn't even have the courage to admit you had a crush on Kylar until you knew he was safely dead.
All the things V had always hated about women were suddenly showing up in herself. For Niso's sake, she even missed Yuli, like some sort of fucking mother.
Well, that was nice. Boo-hoo. Do we feel better now? Because we still have a problem.
She sat on her horse outside Drissa Nile's shop. The bitch witch had said the weaves were dangerous, but Drissa might be able to free V from the God King's magic. Looking at the modest shop, V thought the smart money was on the God King. The God King would make her a slave. Drissa Nile would either free her or kill her.